Women, Peace, and Security Center in Kinshasa. This event will be Sunday, November 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 400 I Street, Southwest. Performers include Navasha Dea, Liani Mataka, Janelle Gill, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and more. More information on this event is available at wpfwfm.org.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, host of We the People, and you're listening to WPFW Washington.
In the backdrop of the two hugely successful No King's Day, there's been a lot of chatter on social media about this isn't our fight. Black people should just sit back and let others do the work. We spend the hour with Larry Hamm, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, who's organized for the No King's March. And we're going to unpack this notion. And we'll also learn how Larry Hamm became Larry Hamm. All that and a whole lot more. Good morning and welcome. I'm Fahima Sek, and the show is What's at Stake. We spend the hour with Larry Hamm, founder and chair of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. We unpack his sojourn and how he came of age. But before we do that, I want to encourage you to continue to support our efforts to bring you stellar programming like this by giving us a call at 1-800-222-9739 or streaming at www.wpfwfm.org and at Cash App, $WPFWFM. We cannot continue to do this without you. Larry, thank you so much for joining us here on WPFW.
Good morning, Fahima, and thank you for having me.
Now, we're going to get into this notion that Black people shouldn't be taking part in this current struggle. But before we do that, I want to get an opportunity to let our listening audience know who Larry Hamm is, how he became to be Larry Hamm. And you've been on the air here as a guest on a number of shows, even throughout Pacifica. But we want to know how you became Larry Hamm. So let's start with, where did you grow up and what was it like?
Well, I was actually born in Washington, D.C. But I grew up in New Jersey, but I was born to Teresa Burton, my birth mother, who passed away 2 years ago at Howard University Hospital. And it's funny you asked me, how did Larry Hamm become Larry Hamm? Well, Larry Hamm was born Anthony Burton, but Larry Hamm didn't find that out till he was 44 years old. I was adopted. I was raised by Grace and Lawrence Hamm, and they brought me to New Jersey as almost a newborn baby, almost as an infant. And I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. I'm a product of Newark Public Schools, South 17th Street School, and Arts High School in Newark, New Jersey. And I had a pretty regular childhood, the childhood of an average Black child. I grew up in the heart of the Central Ward of Newark. The Central Ward historically was the Black community in essence because of redlining. You know, at one time it had the densest Black population in the United States. And I was born in 1953, and Jim Crow was still the law of the land in 53. And remember, I mean, if we had to use a benchmark, it didn't fall automatically, but I guess we could use the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 as benchmarks for the beginning of the end of Jim Crow in the United States. I grew up in a poor working class family, but I have to say this. I was, for the most part, a happy child. I grew up with loving parents and a loving extended family. So whatever I may have been deprived of growing up in poverty, I really didn't feel it. I really didn't understand poverty until I went away to college and saw how other folks lived. That's when I began to understand poverty.
You said you grew up in poverty, and generally when one speaks about growing up in poverty, the suggestion is, you know, going without, doing without. But you ended up going to Rutgers University and then Princeton. So unpack that a little.
Well, how did I get to Princeton University? Well, I guess the critical step was going to Arts High School, which was a school of music and art in Newark. I didn't want to go to Arts High School. I wanted to go to West Side High School because that was I grew up in the neighborhood literally surrounding West Side High School. And had I not gone to Arts High, my life may have taken a different course. I don't know. I mean, West Side High School, I think, has produced several students who also attended Princeton University and certainly Rutgers University and other fine universities. But I got thrown out of school in the eighth grade. You know, as you enter those teenage years, the puberty and so on and so forth. And I ended up getting some trouble and getting thrown out of school. I almost didn't graduate the eighth grade. In fact, they didn't want me. They weren't going to let me graduate the eighth grade. And my mother went to school after my expulsion period was over and literally threw herself on the mercy of the principal. And so I did end up graduating. At that point, I had a teacher in the eighth grade. Her name was Elizabeth Ryerson. She did two things in the eighth grade. Arts High gave the test twice. They gave it once in the fall and once in the spring. I didn't take it in the fall, but after I was expelled and brought back to school, she made me go to take the test at Arts High. And the second thing she did was one day after school, she did something totally unusual for a teacher at that time. She took me downtown Newark to a book signing where I met Jesse Owens. This was in the spring of 1967. And Jesse Owens had just written his autobiography. And that had an impact on me. And then, as I said, she made me take the test to go to Arts High School. And I think I went back to Arts High with the idea that I was going to turn my life around because I really have been going in the wrong direction. But something happened at Arts High. First of all, I didn't even think school was going to start in the fall of 1967 because we had an uprising in Newark in the summer of 1967. We call it the Newark Rebellion. Other people call it the Newark Riots. But it was certainly one of the most cataclysmic civil disturbances in the United States. Probably.
And is that where you and the great Amiri Baraka interfaced?
No. We did not interface then. Okay. I was about 13 years old in 1967. And the first serious discussion I had about race in my family was the night we watched the rebellion begin to unfold in our community. We lived in a three-family wooden frame house. People are probably familiar with these old houses, you know, in the ghetto, in the hood, as people say today. We lived on the second floor. We had a second floor porch and we were sitting out there watching, you know, the rebellion unfold. I mean, the incident that triggered it was only about a mile away from where we lived, but it like spread throughout the city. And, you know, my father passed away when I was 4 years old. My father was a truck driver. My mother was a seamstress. When my father passed away, we moved off Ridgewood Avenue in the Central Ward and went to live with her parents, my grandparents, in the also in the Central Ward. And I asked my grandfather, you know, why was everybody so upset? Because, you know, the stores were being broken into, things were being liberated, as some folks might say, confrontations with the police. We could see all of this happening. And my grandfather began, in the first serious conversation that I remember as a child with me involved, was my grandfather talking about the racism that he experienced while he was in the Army. He didn't even say the racism he experienced in Georgia, you know, where he was born, and other parts of the country where he worked. He started talking about the racism he experienced when he was in the Army, experienced both on this side and in Europe. My grandfather was a World War I veteran. My father was a World War II veteran. And so that was kind of the beginning, the uprising in Newark. And that talk was probably the beginning, you know, of the seeds being planted for my political conscience. So I get to Arts High School. And, you know, like most high schools, they have the beginning school year. They have a student orientation. They asked the student government president, who was then white. Arts High was still somewhat integrated. In 1967, it's not too much now, but in 67, it was. The president of student council was a young white guy, senior. I think his name was David Hammond. And the principal asked David to come talk about the student government, talk about the UNICEF collection and the Halloween party. And David got up there and started talking about the war in Vietnam. And the principal told David, don't talk. And this is from the whole school. Arts High was a small high school. The whole student body could fit in the auditorium. It was about 600 students at that time at Arts High School. So David wouldn't stop talking about the war in Vietnam. And the principal literally started to physically pull David from the podium. And the principal and David got into an altercation in front of the entire student body at Arts High School over the Vietnam War. And I have to be honest, I didn't know anything about Vietnam. You know, I didn't. Not at that time. The war was certainly in full effect by 1967. There were demonstrations, but I really, as a kid, didn't know about Vietnam. That was my first introduction to the Vietnam War. And that incident made me curious about the student council, and I eventually, you know, became a student council rep. So in Newark, there were two teacher strikes, one in 1970 and one in 1971. And the first teacher strike in 70 was a short teacher strike. But during that teacher strike, don't ask me for what reason, I don't know, but there was a convening of the student council. Not the entire student body, just the 30 or 40 student council reps in a room on the first floor of our high school. And the guest speaker was Amiri Baraka. Mm. Now, it's hard to put in words. We knew that we were going to have a guest speaker. And the whisper, the grapevine was saying it was Leroy Jones. This was teachers talking, you know, amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. You would have thought some giant black man, you know, the way these teachers were talking and scrambling, you know. And I have to say, since I was a student government rep, I was there, and I had never seen anything like it. First of all, it was brother at that time, Imamu Amiri Baraka, and he was dressed in all African clothes. He even had an African coat. You know, I haven't seen one like it since, but, you know, people would wear dashikas and stuff, but this was wintertime. So he had a coat. He had on elephant skin shoes, and he had two brothers. At that time, he had an organization called the Committee for a Unified Newark. And he spoke to us in Amiri Baraka. Now, by 1970, we had a black principal in our high school, Teresa David. So he was permitted to come into the school and talk to us about the need for community control of our schools, community control of education in the black community. Ken Gibson had just been elected well, was probably on the way to be. He was sworn in July 1st, 1970. So he hadn't been elected yet. He was in the runoff against Mayor Adonisio. So that was my first meeting with Amiri Baraka. But that didn't begin our ongoing relationship. The next year, we had a second teacher strike. And this teacher strike was the longest teacher strike in the history of the country, maybe still holding the record. But at least up until that time, it was 11 weeks. And what had happened was that, you know, the students were told that if we missed 35 consecutive days of school, we weren't going to graduate. Now, by this time, I was a senior. I was president, or what they call at Arts High, mayor. They call mayor of the student government. And in other high schools, they call it president. I was mayor of the student government. And, you know, nobody really cared much about the student until that time when people thought they weren't going to graduate. You know, many of the seniors were like, well, what is the student council going to do? We got to do something, you know. So we planned a walkout and a march. And about March 23rd, I believe it was, we walked out. About 95% of the students walked out. And we marched down to what was then called the Gateway Hotel. The hotel is still there. Anybody that's been through Newark Penn Station, I'm talking about the hotel across the street from the train station. Now it's called the DoubleTree Hotel. But it was there where the Board of Education and the union were negotiating. And we marched. It was about maybe a mile and a half march, maybe 2 mile march from our school down to the Gateway. And about 200 of us got into the hotel before, you know, people in charge found out what was going on. Then they got their security guards to close the door. So 200 of us were in there, and we actually got up on. I'm not sure if we were on the floor where the negotiations were taking place, but we actually got up into the hotel and sat in on a couple of floors. And this was in 1971. So Ken Gibson had been elected, and our sit-in drew his attention, and he came there and he met with us. And, you know, we had a list of demands. Of course, it included settling whatever the differences were that were causing the strike to be prolonged, to get those settled. But we also had a list of demands to improve education in the city. And Gibson, you know, said that he would do the best he could to get the union and the board to resolve their differences. And he would also make sure our demands were met. Now,
let me just give the station ID. You're listening to Pacifica Radio, WPFW 89.3 on your FM dial, streaming at www.wpfwfm.org. The show is What's at Stake. I'm Fahima Sek, and I'm in a quite engaging discussion with Larry Hamm. Now, was this your first introduction to activism?
Yes. That was my first political act. My first political act wasn't even like going to somebody else's rally or demonstration. You know, the first thing, you know, serious political act was this walkout and this sit-in. So Gibson met with us, and to make a long story short, the result of that meeting was that Ken Gibson decided to appoint me to the Newark Board of Education 3 months later. In fact, I hadn't even graduated yet. In June, one of his aides came to my house and said, the mayor wants to know if you would be interested in being a member of the Board of Education. I was 17 years old. I wasn't even old enough to vote. As a matter of fact, they had just passed the day that I was sworn in as a school board member, July 1st, 1971, was the same day, I believe, that the amendment to the Constitution was ratified that allowed 18-year-olds to vote. Because, you know, people take the vote for granted. A lot of young people don't know that the right of 18-year-olds to vote had a lot to do with the Vietnam War, because a lot of young people were being drafted to go to war, but they could go to war and kill people in Vietnam or get killed, but they couldn't vote.
And that was an accurate argument. If at 18, you could die for this country, but there was a limitation in terms of your rights and your abilities within the country. And one of the most fundamental rights was the right to vote. And that's so right. There was, I presumably, there's a correlation between the struggle around the Vietnam War and 18-year-olds getting the right to vote.
That's right. That's right. And I would stand on that. I would argue that with anybody, you know. Now, what was it true that people were trying to get that right before the Vietnam War? Probably. But I believe had it not been for the Vietnam War, 18-year-olds wouldn't have gotten the right to vote then. Maybe there'd been another crisis in the future. But I believe that they got the right to vote. And then, interestingly, after I was appointed to the Board of Education, you know, this racist assemblyman from the North Ward area of Newark, New Jersey, called for the state attorney general to investigate me for not registering for the draft. You know, so almost from the beginning of my school board term, there was controversy. But I was appointed in July, and it was in August 1971 that Amiri Baraka and I had our first sit-down meeting. And he invited me up to what was called the Hikalu Umoja, the House of Unity, which literally, by the way, was one block away from my high school. I actually had to pass their headquarters every day to go back and forth to school. But I never went in there, you know. But there would be brothers, you know, outside. The brothers would be in their uniforms with their green dashikis and their black pants and black combat boots, you know, and they would say Habari Gani, you know, and I didn't know what to say back because I didn't know Swahili. I didn't even know they were speaking Swahili. But Baraka and I met, and, you know, I went in thinking the meeting was going to be one way, you know, and it turned out to be totally different. You know, and what I mean is that he was very personable and forthcoming. You know, it wasn't like I'm the great leader, you know, and you're a kid. You know, he spoke to me as a young adult, and he wanted to know what my political ideas were, and he shared his ideas, and, you know, and expressed an interest into working together. And from that point on, we worked closely together over the years. The other thing that happened that same month, I was invited to, because it was like national news that Ken Gibson had appointed a 17, like I wasn't the student representative on the board. I was one of the 9 voting school. The board had 9 members. I was one of the 9.
With the same and rights and privileges as anyone else.
Same rights and privileges, same power, same authority. I was a voting school board member. I know a lot of people said, well, oh, he must have been on the student advisory board, or maybe he was the 10th member could give comment but can't vote. No, I was one of the 9 voting school board members. So that was like national news. You know, it's in all the newspapers, Time, Newsweek, Magazine, et cetera, et cetera. So I got a letter from Coretta Scott King. They wanted to give me a youth leadership award at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference convention, which was in New Orleans in that year. So they flew me down, you know. And at that time, I got to meet just about all of the living, you know, civil rights leaders whose names we still know today. Like, they were all there. All of them except Dr. King, who had been assassinated in 1968. I met all of them. First of all, I received the award from the hands of Coretta Scott King. I met Jesse Jackson, met Andrew Young, met Hosea Williams. I met Rosa Parks, you know. And when I came back from the SCLC conference, I made a motion to rename Waverly Avenue School Rosa Parks Elementary School. In fact, during the tenure, my school board tenure, I either introduced the resolutions or voted for resolutions to change the names. Those schools that have black names in Newark probably got those names during the period that I was on the Board of Education. We had a Martin Luther King School. We had a Harriet Tubman School. We had a Marcus Garvey School. With much, much, much controversy, we changed the name of Southside High School to Malcolm X Shabazz High School. It is still Malcolm X Shabazz High School, even though there have been attempts over the years to change it back to Southside High School and so on and so forth. But my tenure on the school board was quite controversial. I'm sure Gibson got a lot of pressure to try to remove me from the school board. Suffice it to say, he didn't reappoint me.
Was there resistance from fellow board members or just the community?
Yes. Well, there was one member on the board. His name was John Servais. When I was appointed to the school board, I think I became the fifth black member. So the school board became majority black with my appointment in 1971. And then there was another a younger person, not young as I was, but Vicki Donaldson. She was appointed. So it made it 6-3. And sometimes the votes were 6-3. Sometimes they weren't 6-3.
But the Supreme Court.
Yes, yes. But the consistent opposition was the white representative from the North Ward of Newark, John Servais. And Servais would rail against me. He would get in the newspapers, you know, the black militant. Amiri Baraka, I was the youngest delegate to the National Black Political Convention in 1972. I was an elected delegate to Gary. I don't know, Fahim, I'm sure you know the history of Gary.
Oh, yes.
And many people who are not familiar with that history, they know that there was a convention, but they don't know that the voting delegates to that convention, and I think there were about 3,000 voting delegates and another 6,000 or 7,000 people who came as observers. They were elected. There was a whole convention movement to get people to Gary. Like, we had an Essex County Black Political Convention. See, going back to 1967, you know, there was a Black Power Conference held in Newark literally during the rebellion. And to this day, I'm like, how did Maulana Karanga, H-Rap Brown, and so many others get in here during that time? But on the 20th of July, 67, there was a Black Power Conference. The following year, there was a Black Power Convention at West Kenny Junior High School in the Central Ward. The following that year, 1969, there was a Black and Puerto Rican Convention. And that led to the Community's Choice team, of which Ken Gibson was running for mayor, and a number of black people were running for council seats. It was a whole slate. It wasn't just Gibson. It was Gibson and a slate of city council candidates. Gibson won, and three of them won. Although Gibson won in 70, we didn't have a majority black city council until the following election, municipal election in 1974. And then after that, you know, there was the Pan-African Congress that was held in Atlanta in 1970, and then the National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana, in 1972.
This is the convention that the candidate, the first black woman, then president Shirley Chisholm, chose not to attend. And I've heard a lot coming out.
You know the history, don't you? You know the history.
But I want to, I mean, you're someone who was actually there, you know, yes. And, you know, I've heard tale of people saying, you know, that she didn't come to the meeting, and perhaps if she had come, she would have gotten the nomination from the organization, and that there were those that supported her and then those that were portrayed her. Was she a subject of discussion, as far as you know, at that at the convention?
Yes, it was discussed. And there people were like holding their breath. You know, now when I say people, remember, there were leaders of the convention, and then there were like the rank and file delegates. So I can speak for what was happening among the rank and file delegates. We were hoping that she was going to attend. And it's, we can only speculate now. It's water under the bridge. We can't say with any certainty. I would speculate that if she had come and asked for the endorsement of the convention, I think she would have got it. Now, would she have had some opposition? I think she might have had some opposition. But I think she would have won. I think she would have won. And, you know, there were a number of controversial issues. You know, it's very interesting, you know, that in this day and time, one of the most, the foremost issues in the world today is the Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinians in Gaza. Do you know that the issue of Palestinian liberation was a major issue at Gary?
Oh, I'm not surprised, because the first, in fact, Malcolm X wrote an essay that was in the Jerusalem, not the Jerusalem Time, it was in the Egyptian Herald, called Zionist Logic. And people continue to conflate the two issues, because there are many people who are Jewish who are in opposition to what's going on in Palestine. And it's not an issue of people. It's an issue of Zionism, which is, in fact, I understand the largest amount of Zionists are actually Christian nationalists. You know, these fundamentalists have a lot to do with this whole issue.
Let me tell you what happened. Let me tell you what happened to Gary. So, you know, what came out of Gary was the national black political agenda. And I would really urge everyone that has not done so, because I know some people have done this, but I'm talking to the people who haven't done it yet. And maybe those who looked at it one time, I say, take a second look at it today. It's online. You don't have to buy it. You can look up national black political agenda from the National Black Political Convention, Gary, Indiana, 1972. So there were plenary sessions where we passed the resolutions that ultimately made up the national black political agenda. And there was an international affairs section. And under international affairs, there was one plank, one short paragraph that said the National Black Political Convention supports self-determination for the Palestinian people. I don't even think it said a separate state or anything like that. I think it basically says self-determination for the Palestinian people. Man, all hell broke out. The leader of the Michigan delegation came to the microphone from the floor. Their delegation was sitting above us in the balcony. We were on the in the auditorium, on the main floor of the auditorium. Huge delegation from Michigan. Their spokesman came forward and said that if the convention passed that resolution, they were going to take the Michigan delegation out of the convention. The person who said that was an organizer named Coleman Young. I don't know if that name is familiar to you, but Coleman.
I think I have heard of Coleman Young around politics. Yeah,
that's right. Yes, he went on to become the first black mayor of Detroit, Michigan. And all hell broke out. Debate going back and forth. That day, Amiri Baraka, still Imamu Baraka, you know, he was, you know, his name had been, when he changed his name, when he was a Muslim, a Sunni Muslim, it was Amir Baraka. And then, you know, he connected with Maulana Karanga and the Congress of African People. And his name became Imamu Amiri Baraka. Imamu was like a rank in that whole Qawida movement. You know, there were only four or five imam. And then Maulana was like a rank too. Maulana was the top, you know, and then there were four or five imamus under Karanga. And so there was Imamu Amiri Baraka in Newark. So he was Imamu Baraka. He was chairing the plenary session at that time. And I have to say, had it been anybody else, I think the convention would have fallen apart. But he was able to hold it together, was able to get to a vote. The platform plank was approved by the majority of people, and the Michigan delegation was taken out. Now, there was a split in the Michigan delegation. Now, I have to say, from where I sat...
Let's make that a cliffhanger. I want to take a musical break.
Okay. All right.
And we're going to come back from that cliffhanger. And we will be right back on the other side of this. I'm Fahima Sek, and the show is What's at Stake. And we just heard Kenny Boubien, I Shall Not Be Moved. And we were at a cliffhanger where all hell broke loose, and Imamu Amiri Baraka saved.
Yeah, he saved the convention, because the whole thing could have fallen apart at that point. At least this is now, I'm saying this to you as I saw it. As a young, impressionable, I was 18 then in 1972. And I have to tell you, the National Black, you're talking about how I became who I am, the National Black Political Convention had a major, it was a transforming event for me. You know, it really was. But Amiri Baraka was at the podium, and he was appealing to people to stay together, to get through this. And it was pretty raucous, but he held it together. But, you know, Coleman Young, he had control of that delegation. So they did walk out. Now, there seemed to be a split in the delegation, because there were some that did not leave and some that came back in. But the way the New York Times recorded it, and there's an article, you can Google it, you know, you can read all, you can at least read the Times, you know, keep in mind that's the Times.
I'd rather go into some archives, because you can't trust everything you
that's
find
right.
on Google.
That's right.
I'd rather go into the archives for the Black newspaper or
yes.
the Library of Congress or something
yes.
like that.
Yes, 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 yes. So, you know, when the convention was over, by the way, the three conveners of the National Black Political Convention were Amiri Baraka, Imamu Amiri Baraka at that time, and then Richard Hatcher, who was mayor of Gary, and Congressman Charles Diggs from Detroit. And, you know, I think they made a good team, because they each brought a different kind of constituency. You know, and everybody was there. It was like that song, The Function at the Junction. Everybody was there. you know, Coretta Scott King and Sister Betty Shabazz were both there. I think they both spoke. Jesse Jackson, of course, there's a film out on the convention called Nation Time. And you see, you know, Jesse Jackson. But I always felt some kind of way about that film because I felt that it really didn't give Amiri Baraka the credit, because I really think that the 24/7 work that Baraka was doing in his organization, and not just the Committee for Unified Newark from New Jersey, but the entire Congress of African People from all around the country, you know, they played a major role in putting that convention together and holding it together. And when the convention was over, I asked, when we got back to Newark, I asked Baraka to give me an African name because I was transfigured. You know, I was out of the Central Ward of Newark. My grandmother was a regular church goer, but I wasn't a regular church goer. I had never seen Black people come together and operate in unity like that. I mean, it just firmly put me, you know, on the path of the Black liberation movement. I asked Amiri Baraka to give me an African name, and he gave me the name of Dimu Chunga. And I never legally changed my name, but I've always used that name and still use that name. And those who were my friends through the years, they still call me that, you know, but legally, especially since I was running for office, I was still using Lawrence Ham, and still that's my legal name.
So two things. One, in terms of the point of view that you feel was left out, that's a project that can be done. Just like there have been many films on Dr. King, many films on the civil rights movement. And you, of course, we have Eyes on the Prize. Yes. Was done a part. Yes. Actually a part two. And so that's a project that can, in fact, be done.
Yes. Eyes on the Prize 2 does have footage, does have a chapter on the Gary convention. And I think if it was something, you know, because a lot of movies are made from scripts, right? They start with some type of written document. And I think Kamozi Woodard's book, Nation Within a Nation, by Kamozi Woodard, who is a professor at Sarah Lawrence University now, he was a member. That's one of the reasons I have such respect. And I always recommend his book because he was in the movement. He wasn't somebody outside the movement that decided to write about it. He was in that movement, you know, and I would recommend if people really want to get an inside view or one inside view, because his book is not the only one, but his book, Nation Within a Nation, by Dr. Kamozi Woodard. And people might even invite him to speak, you know, either come in person or set up verse, because he was on the scene. You know,
now from this rebirthing of yourself. Mm-hmm. So you tell us how you got to Princeton. And then in the last segment, we'll look at, you know, this notion that Black people need to sit this out. And you, as chair of the People Organization of Progress, have been organizing people to participate in the No Kings, both of the No Kings.
Right.
Right. Mark. And so to just share how you ended up getting to Princeton, and then we'll go into that.
Well, I got to Princeton because I applied. And when I was in school, you know, I applied to three. When I was in high school, I applied to three universities, Princeton, Harvard, and Yale. And I got accepted at all three. And I decided to go to Princeton because I was from a poor Black family. I had to go to the school that was going to give me, you know, the best financial aid package. And that's how I got to Princeton University. And when I got to Princeton, I was still on the school board. And I couldn't do both because the school system, you remember the rebellion had just been 4 years earlier. The school system was roiling with struggle. You know, because Black people really were trying to get community control of the schools. I had school board meetings no less than three times a week. A week. People think of the public meeting once a month. No, there are committee meetings and other meetings three times a week. There was no way I could do Princeton and do the school board. So in the fall of 1971, I withdrew from Princeton University. And just as my appointment to the board was front page news, when I left Princeton, that was front page news. And you can imagine it wasn't favorable news. I remember seeing my mother's face when she picked up the Star Ledger, school board member drops out of Princeton, you know, and my poor mother, you know, she got the worst of it. When I was on the school board one time, the students came to the school board meeting and they were complaining that the teachers wouldn't like let them bring the Black Liberation flag for Black History Month, you know, the red, black and green. So I had a motion passed that the red, black and green flag should be used as a teaching tool and students should be able to bring it to school. And the board passed it. It was like it came from me as a decree. Man, the next day, all the newspapers, the television stations, school board, Black militant school board member raises the Black Liberation flag, wants to take down the American flag. Oh, man, my poor mother, one day after work, was home watching her stories. The vice president of public affairs for ABC television came on, interrupted the programming to editorialize against me, you know. And, you know, my folks was regular folks. They weren't in the movement. My mother wasn't in the movement. My, you know, I don't even think my folks were in NAACP. My grandfather was a boiler man. He went to work every day. My mother was a seamstress. She went to work every day. Worked literally around the corner in the cleaners. She was a seamstress in the cleaners around the corner. You know, they were regular folk. And, you know, I was getting all this.
They even interrupted the stories.
Yes, to editorial. And my mother would say to me, Larry, why are you throwing your life away? Because, you know, it was a big thing when I got thrown out of school, you know, in eighth grade. And then I went to Arts High. I was trying to turn my life around, you know. I mean, how did I get to Princeton? Right. You know, I was number 7th in my class academically. I was a state champion, 2-miler. You know, I was the Group 1 school state champion, record holder. I was the first person to break 10 minutes in the 2-mile in the history of the city of Newark. You know, I was all that stuff, right? Like in the Archie comics, right? I was kind of like the Black Archie, you know, until I ran into Amiri Baraka, you know, and that was like the beginning of the transformation it was a benchmark in the transformation of my political consciousness. In 1982, I got together with some of those who had been student activists, high school student activists with me, even before I got appointed to the board. And 9 of us came together. And in 1982, we formed the People's Organization for Progress.
Now, we're under the tyranny of the clock.
Yes.
And I know that the People's Organization for Progress also was very much a part of the anti-apartheid movement.
Yes.
And a number of other efforts. And it comes to this question that I'm sure you may have seen it online.
Yes.
We're going to sit this one out. We're going to do boots on the ground, and it's not our responsibility. But you and a number of other organizations, I know BLM Grassroots, have been actively engaged. So unpack that in the time that we have remaining.
You're asking a lot, but I'll give it a try. Let me say this. POP opposed Donald Trump when he ran for president the first time, even from his first campaign. Well, I say it was actually his second, because he did try to run for president earlier. But when he was elected in 16, before he was elected, you know, we knew about his fascist tendencies. And, you know, we marched against Trump. We had a march against Trump in 15, and we had Trump must go marches all during his presidency. You know, so we were always opposed. And, you know, it just took time for his movement to evolve so that a lot of people who did not see it that way in 15, they certainly began to see it by 20 or during his first term. And then it became clear to many people with the attempted coup, January 6, 2021. But there were still people out there with all of that was still supporting him. But, you know, we tried to fight to defend the interests of Black people, working people, poor people, oppressed people. And we try to unite and fight with together, unite and work together with people who are fighting for justice. And so we always felt compelled to protest against Trump's policies because Trump has always been attacking the Black community. You know, people talking about we're going to sit this one out. How are we going to sit it out when he's sending troops to Black communities? How are we going to sit it out when ICE is not just arresting so-called undocumented immigrants, they're arresting naturalized citizens and U.S. citizens too, and Black people. Ask the people in Chicago. ICE has been arresting Black people too.
And Portland all of the as well. That's as right. As well as Memphis, Tennessee. And we got an ever-present presence here in Washington, D.C. In fact, they may very well be here, they said, until next year when they celebrate the anniversary of the country.
Right. I came to D.C. to march with y'all. I think it was on the 28th. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the POP members went to the Wall Street March, and this is the way we planned it. You know, it wasn't like, you know, people was going on their own here and going, no, we planned it. We said, those that want to go to the march on Wall Street, that was the march that Sharpton called, because we should be targeting these corporations. And then some of us are going to go to Washington and march with our brothers and sisters in Washington. And I went to Washington, I think it was on the 28th, and spoke at Metropolitan, is that Metropolitan AME Church?
Yes, Metropolitan AME Church. Yes. Pre-DC sponsored that march.
Yes, yes. I spoke there and then we went, you know, and protested. And then I came back. And when your union, when the unions had that rally on DuPont Circle, mm-hmm. we came there and marched with people there because we felt that the takeover of DC by troops was not just an attack on Black people in Washington, D.C. We thought that was an attack on all Black people. Because if Trump is going to get away with it in D.C., and as he has done, he's going to try to do it everywhere. And now he has the Supreme Court backing him up, right? They said he could send the troops to Portland, Oregon, you know, but he really, you know, wanted Chicago. And I take my hat off. I salute the brothers and sisters in Chicago who have been putting up massive resistance. I mean, people don't understand how critical. I mean, this is almost like some pre-Civil War stuff. You know, the kinds of things that led up to the Civil War. These were the kinds of things, you know, the disagreement between states over certain policies. I mean, you got Governor Pritzker resisting the presence of troops in Illinois. And then he's backing up the mayor of Chicago, who is Black, who, by the way, I salute that brother, who's calling for a general strike. Do you know how serious that is?
I think he is paving the way and giving a direction as to where the position the legislatures should take. And sadly, everyone is not following that same mode.
But just the mere fact that he's putting it in the air.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That he's
absolutely
putting it. I don't know who's going to support him, who's not going to support him. But the idea of a general strike, that is a revolutionary idea. I don't think there's been a general strike in my lifetime. And we'll probably have to have that and more to resist what Trump is trying to do. Now, I know a lot of people, and it's true, if you look at, because pot didn't start with no kings. We took buses to D.C. in February for the hands-off rally that was in front of the Capitol.
Yes.
We were in the first No Kings in June. We were in the Good Trouble in July on John Lewis's birthday.
Yes, in the spirit of John Lewis. We're going to have to end it here. As I said, we were under the tyranny of the clock. But let those in our listening audience know how they can connect with yourself and People's Organization for Progress.
Well, the best way to connect with People's Organization for Progress is to call us directly at 973-801-0001, 973-801-0001. We're always trying to build alliances ever since the troops, were placed in Washington. That has given us a heightened feeling of responsibility to develop more contacts and more connections with the people in D.C., because the struggle in D.C. is critical. What happens in the what do y'all call it? The District of Maryland and Virginia? Is that what y'all call it? The District of Columbia has implications for the rest of us throughout the country. So
in PG County, they call it the Ninth Ward. But we really have ran out of time. And I just want to thank you so much for agreeing to join us today, Brother Larry Hamm, People's Organization for Progress. I want to also say that those of you that pledged during our pledge drive, please honor your pledges. I'm Fahima Sek, and the show is What's at Stake, and I'll see you the next time.
Support for WPFW comes in part from Friends of the Congo, a 501c3 entity that will be hosting Love Sound, an evening of soul sisters in support of WPFW and Friends of the Congo's DRC Women, Peace, and Security Center in Kinshasa. This event will be Sunday, November 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 400 I Street Southwest. Performers include Navasha Dea, Liani Mataka, Janelle Gill, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and more. More information on this event is available at WPFWFM.org.
The place to be in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, November 1st, 5 to 8 p.m. is the Paul Robeson Peace and Justice Awards Gala. Named in the honor of the champion of civil rights, the event honors Josh Williams with keynote speaker Tom Porter. The evening includes dinner and entertainment by Freak Benjamin, Veronica Fashion, the Warrior Drumline Youth Group, and Wata. At the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest, and is presented by the D.C. Friends of the People's World and the Claudia Jones School of Political Education. Details, 202-977-1407. Once again, details at 202-977-1407. We'll see you there.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, host of We the People, and you're listening to WPFW Washington.
Support for WPFW comes in part from Friends of the Congo, a 501c3 entity who will be hosting Love Sound, an evening of Soul Sisters in support of WPFW and the Friends of the Congo's DRC Women, Peace, and Security Center in Kinshasa. This event will take place on Sunday, November 2nd, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church at 400 I Street Southwest. Performers include Free Benjamin, Wena, Anna Mwalago, Ayana Gregory, and more. More information on this event is available at WPFWFM.org.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, host of We the People, and you're